Let's go right into meditation. Begin by settling the body in its natural state. And as you relax ever more deeply with each exhalation, especially in the evening sessions after a dinner, it's important to maintain clarity. So as you relax more and more deeply, recognize the clarity that you begin the meditation with, and use that as your baseline for introspection. If you feel more lax or dull than you do right now, then apply an antidote. Posture, gaze, even standing up. And bring this balance of relaxation and clarity to know the effortless silence of speech settled in its natural state. You can begin to think of these preliminary practices of settling body, speech, and mind in their natural states as the states you discovered with your morning prayers, with the empowerments from Padmasambhava that purified your identification with being the body, speech, and mind of a sentient being. And having purified that identification, what do you discover? The natural state is not something that you create. It is there waiting to be discovered when you stop doing what is obscuring it. And so now settle the mind in its natural state. This is not the natural state of a sentient being, but the mind's natural state. This is the natural state of mind that you share with Padmasambhava. And from that perspective, rest in stillness and spaciousness of awareness. with no appearances. Rest in resplendent emptiness. Familiarizing yourself with this stillness and spaciousness is just the preliminary to the main practice. So now, shift your interest with intention on the sliding scale simply to allow appearances to flow unimpeded. And as you shift your vantage point, or your, well, don't shift your vantage point. Simply allow appearances to arise within that still, spacious awareness. The emptiness is still resplendent, but now that luminous quality of the mind is illuminating appearances, both objective, subjective, compound appearances. And to maintain the stillness of your awareness means to practice without distraction by the objective appearances, going off wandering with them, and without identification with the subjective appearances. Feel a radical impartiality to whatever appearance arises. Without preferring that it stay, or without preferring that it go. Without clinging to the pleasant or rejecting the unpleasant. The path to single-pointedness begins with recognizing the difference between stillness of your awareness and the movement of appearances. So these attractive and alluring appearances, some of which you are so familiar with, your specialty, can you view them as simply motion? What is to like or dislike about motion? You begin the path to single-pointedness with knowing the difference between stillness and motion. Then you have a simultaneous experience, a unified experience of stillness and motion. You know this motion to be arising within the greater context of the space of the mind. So you're simultaneously aware of both still, spacious awareness and the movement that arises within that. As your awareness remains still, without grasping to these appearances, your temporal and qualitative vividness becomes more and more acute. At first, these objective appearances may be more like silhouettes. And they just become richer and richer in detail as you become more and more familiar with this lucid dream. Then you might recognize that not only do these objective appearances seem to come with subjective appearances, But you can see the subjective and the objective in this compound appearance at the same time, in a single glance. Because these appearances don't last that long. So you're not going to just hold it there and do analysis on it. You have to see what there is to see all at once. So it's like the facets of a diamond. Objective appearance, subjective response to it, associated memories, a sense of I, the subject, the witness, all of it wrapped up into a single appearance that you can see all at once. When you become aware that your mind has been wandering, don't suddenly prefer and rejoice at your recovered lucidity. Now, let the dream flow on. And it is just the slightest touch of lucidity is all that's required to find that sweet spot on the scale of simultaneous stillness and motion. Ooh, a lot in the mailbox today. I'm going to deal from the bottom of the deck. Oh, a two-pager. That is definitely dirty poker. Remember yesterday I asked you if it was stillness in motion or stillness and motion, and you said it was the and, stillness and motion, yep. And actually if there was an in there, it would be more accurate to say motion and stillness, right? And you said it was the and. Well, I've been meditating on stillness in motion all the time throughout your teachings. Guess what? It has been thinking about stillness in motion that has gotten me to it. I studied thought concentrated on stillness in motion all the time. So stillness in motion is exactly what we are trying to avoid. Right? So we're trying to maintain the stillness of our still awareness. And it is, what is it that sets stillness in motion? Grasping, right? Grasping to one of these appearances. And so, I think that's, so regardless of, you know, the wording, I hope it's clear that what we are trying to do is maintain the stillness of our still awareness. So awareness is naturally still, but it is set in motion by grasping. So that's an unnatural motion, you could say. And so that is the whole point. First of all, you are able to distinguish the difference between stillness of your awareness and the movement of mental appearances. And then when we grasp to these appearances that arise, what happens is that it's like Velcro or something, you know, you basically are grasping on to the mental appearance, and it's as if you're water skiing or something, and then all of a sudden, woo, you know, off you go with it. So that then the stillness is set in motion. So that is exactly what we are trying to avoid with all of these practices. And, you know, we'll talk a lot more about it tomorrow, the radical impartiality is a real key to maintaining that stillness and not grasping. The greater the mental afflictions, the mightier the primordial wisdom. Please explain. We'll leave that one to, let's see, who was it? The Great Expanse of the Dakinis, I think. Or the Blazing Expanse of the Dakinis. so I'd have to look at the whole... It's these paradoxical constructions. Let me find that. Oh, that's right, I've got a handout. What page is it? Six. Yeah, so the Tantra, the Blazing Clear Expanse of the Dakinis states, all adventition arising of ideation is the display of awareness, so there is no need to block it. So that is basically what explains all of these paradoxical statements that follow it. So that's what you get right there. So you don't need to know anything more. What this is really is another statement of what we're going to be examining tomorrow, which is that all appearances are pure appearances of the ground. And so because they are pure appearances, there's no reason to prefer one over another. And in fact, it is the radical proposition that there is a perspective from which there's no preferring samsara over nirvana, or nirvana over samsara, even. That both of these appearances of samsara, appearances of nirvana, are equally pure appearances of the ground. And of course, the one perspective from which that is true is when you're resting in pristine awareness. So he's talking about, here they are talking about, I wonder even who the author of the Tantra, the Blazing Clear Expanse of the Dakinis is. But anyway, all adventitious arising, so that would be all basically in of conventional reality. So adventitious means no inherent existence. It comes basically produced by causes and conditions and etc. But there's no inherent nature to it. So ideation, so this is the great source of another quote mentioned, the ideation is the source of samsara. Ideation and conceptuality, two different authors stated basically the same thing. So this ideation is the display of awareness. So as a display of awareness, and here's what you could put in parentheses there, pristine awareness or non-dual pristine, or pristine awareness which is non-dual from the absolute space of phenomena. So because of that, there's no need to block it. These are all appearances. And then these paradoxical statements with while conceptualization arises, non-conceptuality grows. Because these are both appearances of awareness. And, you could take, you could parse these in all kinds of different ways. But as the volume of, you could say, of conceptual appearances arises, there's no reason that would set your still awareness in motion. Because you can have, as we will examine tomorrow, or hear a citation tomorrow, that you can be resting in emptiness still. You can be resting in non-conceptual emptiness and be viewing the conceptual mind at work. So there's no reason that simply because of conceptuality arising that would mean that non-conceptuality doesn't grow. So it's, I think they're getting our attention with these paradoxical statements to prove the point that all of these are equally pure displays of pristine awareness. While suffering arises, bliss increases. what suffering we associate with samsara, bliss we associate with nirvana. Again, no distinction between, ultimate distinction. If you're resting in samsara with the mind of a sentient being, then yes, there is, you do prefer bliss to suffering. But from the ultimate perspective, when you're resting in pristine awareness, there is no difference. The greater the mental afflictions, the mightier the primordial wisdom. Again, getting your attention. But if you know that, that mental afflictions are not inherently existent. And in fact, there is, you could say, a two-stage analysis of which you can say that mental afflictions have an essential nature of, for instance, anger. What is the essential nature of anger? So it has a relative essential nature of clarity, right? So there, you could say, in relation to substrate consciousness, it has one, and then in relation to the five facets of primordial consciousness, there is an absolute nature. And so for anger, it's mirror-like, right? Isn't it? Pristine awareness. So anger, so what is anger? So anger arises. So here the statement is, mental affliction arises, and primordial wisdom, the greater the mental afflictions, the mightier the primordial wisdom. So let's just talk about intensity of a mental affliction. The more intense the anger, what is it? What is the intensity of anger? Does it have an inherent nature? It depends on where you're viewing it from, right? And if you're viewing it from substrate consciousness, anger arises as a mental appearance. And what is it? What you see is its essential nature, here, quote, parentheses, relative essential nature, which is clarity, or you could say vividness. And when you think about it, that makes total sense. This is one of the things that in research in cultivating emotional balance, that is, people report that there is an enjoyment factor to anger. And for one, there is, there is, because of the, what Paul Ekman terms the refractory period, you can really be righteous, you know, when you're angry. And all of the countervailing information, even in your own memory, about you have no reason to be righteous, dude. All of that is not available to you. You know, so everything is just becomes very clear, you know, black and white, and I am right, and you are the message of anger, or the trigger for anger is obstacles or obstruction. You are obstructing, placing an obstruction on my path to happiness, basically, of what I want. And so what is the, and then people, the intensity, the emotional intensity, what does that feel like? Why is that, for some people, really enjoyable? Well, there is this intensity of clarity there. And so, when you get to the five facets of primordial consciousness, you know, then it is this mirror-like primordial consciousness. So, Alan has said, and I think this is really true, that, so what are the three attributes of substrate consciousness? Non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss, right? And he says, he just, you know, sometimes he just kind of, you know, throws off these things in just kind of these brilliant soliloquies, you know. And this what I think is one of those. It's not really based on, you know, most of what he says is really, you can footnote. But this isn't, I don't think, this is just his surmising, you know, and it's really cool. Most of our pursuit of pleasure in this world as, you know, ordinary beings, as people in samsara who go to work every morning and work too much, why are we doing it? Why do we need a six-figure income? You know, it's to get these three things, non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. But we mistake what is the delivery of the non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss. So what is the non-conceptuality? Well, opioids would be a really good, I think, easily available delivery vehicle for that. And what about the clarity? So non-conceptuality, luminosity. So luminosity, clarity are synonymous. You know, clarity, vividness, luminosity, they're all in this family. What is it, you know, that people are doing? What? Coffee. Yeah. What? And extreme sports. You know. I have a lot of friends, or I used to have anyway. I had seven friends who died in 1 year when I was much younger. But and when I was, even recently when I was in Lake Tahoe, you know, when I was out in the mountains, extreme sports really hadn't been invented yet. And, you know, we thought we were doing extreme things, but, you know, what people are doing now is just crazy. And so, you know, I had people coming to meditation class that were, Tahoe's real hotbed of, you know, all kinds of extreme sports. So it was just interesting talking to these people and, you know, their motivation. And mostly it's that feeling of aliveness, focus. So I'm not sure, I haven't seen Free Solo, but I've seen snippets of it. But I would guess that this is what, you know, I remember earlier, I think it was the same guy, talking basically about, you know, the transcendental nature of what he was doing, you know, and the focus and how that transported him out of himself and all of that. So non-conceptuality, luminosity, and then the bliss, you know, pursuit of love, sex, you know, all of that. So interesting to think that these, we all, you know, so this is his hypothesis, that we all have this real innate longing and drive for these three things. And then we just go about it, kind of screw it all up, because we've, in this culture, we've never had models for how to go, you know, what is authentic non-conceptuality, luminosity, and bliss, and how do you go about doing it? And all of the models that we have are, you know, drug addiction, love addiction, sex addiction, and extreme sports, you know, and hero worship for all of them. So something like that, I think. Thank you, Roy, for, is it Roy or Ray? What?
It's Dakinis. Is this the female?
Yeah.
Well,
it wouldn't necessarily be that the tantra was composed by a woman, though. So, yeah. So the Dakinis definitely refers to females, and we'll be talking more tonight. Well, actually, no Dakinis appear in our story tonight, but. During merging mind and space, the top of my head felt unusual pressure. Yikes. Is that okay? During merging mind and space, the top of my head felt unusual pressure. yeah, that's okay. So all of these things are, you know, so that would be classed as a nyam. So a nyam is a transient meditative experience. And a transient and anomalous meditative experience, or an experience that is produced by meditation. It doesn't necessarily occur in meditation. There are external, internal, and secret nyam. But so basically, a lot of what you are going to experience in your life as you go deeper and deeper into these practices, you could chalk up to nyam. You're dredging the unconscious, you're moving prana in the body, all of that. And so these are transient effects. And the key to responding to all of these effects, even when they manifest in the environment, so they manifest in the environment, in your body, or in your mind, is to not grasp to them. Don't reify them. Just recognize them for what they are, is just transient appearances, and let them go. So that being said, you can, you know, there are all kinds of reasons that you can think of why you might feel pressure on the top of your head when you're doing this practice. So there is the crown chakra up here with the, how many petals in that chakra? Is it 100? How many? 32? I'll take that, since I can't remember. But anyway, there are a lot of spokes up there at that chakra. You know, so 32 sounds about right. And so it could be that you're when you think of space and merging mind in space, would make sense that prana would go to the crown. And so you might have just been feeling a surge of prana there. Or you might have just been experiencing the physical pliancy of shamatha. You know, because this is, you know, who knows? Well, I don't know. So one of the first signs of the transition from to shamatha, actually, just before you develop the mental and physical pliancy, it said, is that there is a pressure on the top of the head, like a freshly shaved head, a warm hand pressing on the top of a freshly shaved head. And you feel it like this, you know, pressure there. And that is one of the, and that usually is a precursor. So just because you feel that doesn't mean it's a precursor, but apparently everybody who achieves shamatha feels that there's a sign that always accompanies it. So maybe that's it. Is the shamatha without a sign practice we practice today and distinguished from vipassana mainly by the fact that we do not engage the conceptual analytic mental faculties? I think yes. A real vipassana practice always involves inquiry. So you're asking a question and doing analysis and looking for, you know, typically the ultimate nature of something under examination. So we're going to talk tomorrow about the fusion of shamatha and vipassana. And one of the things that is so exhilarating about this path of Sokchen and Duchamp Lingpa's presentation is that, everybody agrees that shamatha is the first step, you know, so all traditions agree on that. Essential first step, if you're going to have genuine experience of genuine wisdom, the direct perception of emptiness, you have to achieve shamatha first. So pretty much, you know, all Buddhist traditions say that. So then the question, there are a couple of interesting things you could ask then. As Jason Kappa points out in the Lam Rim Chenmo, Volume 3, he asks he's debating, and he asks, does expecting he basically says, all of the traditions agree that when you experience the direct perception of emptiness, it is a non-conceptual experience, right? So anybody gonna argue with that? So it's a non-conceptual experience. So does saying that conceptual analytical meditation can produce the non-conceptual experience of authentic insight, does that violate the rule that cause and effect must be of the same nature? So interesting thought. And there are, you know, he does finesse it and all of that, but it's a really interesting point, isn't it? So if you are interested in non-conceptual experience, wouldn't you start cultivating non-conceptual causes early in the path of that, rather than expecting that you're going to just do more and more enhanced or more and more sophisticated, more and more elaborate conceptuality, and then suddenly pop, you know, something happens and whoa, the big non-conceptuality. So I think this is exactly why Padmasambhava said some traditions teach view by meditation. So I teach view by way of meditation. Some teach meditation by way of view, that you start with the view and then spend 20, 25 years studying the view, you know, in all of its intricacies. And then at some point, you know, so he says that approach makes it very difficult to identify. So, and he said to identify. So it means identify within your own mind stream or your own awareness, to identify pristine awareness. And then if you take the other approach of meditation, you know, largely non-conceptual, what in this approach, or that it makes it difficult not to identify. So, you know, that's, you know, one way that you can really, you know, these two different paths are very, very different in that way. What was the question? Oh, Vipassana. Yeah. So that's one of the really exhilarating things about this, is that even though, so everybody agrees that you have to achieve shamatha first, so you could do it in a, basically with breath, you know, and tactile sensations, the whole path. You can achieve shamatha not with, by way of tactile sensations, but that can be your, breath meditation can be your focus. And then when you get up to level 7 or something like that, then you have these the acquired sign shows up, which is a mental rather than a physical thing, and et cetera. And then, but rather than that, this path just begins to really take the mind as your object while for developing shamatha. And as I mentioned earlier today, stability and vividness are what you're after, even while you're working with these appearances of the mind. So you're ostensibly doing shamatha practice, but the vipassana implications are unescapable. You know, so for instance, what is the first mark of existence that you examine in the four applications of mindfulness? The body, right? But the mark, so that's the domain, but the mark of existence, the vipassana question, impermanence. So, and that is that is the quintessential vipassana practices that the Buddha taught. You know, how to inquire about something under observation. But so as you are trying to rest, you are taking aspects of the mind as the path, as a vipassana or shamatha practice? Shamatha practice, right? And so what is your inescapable conclusion about the permanence of mental appearances as you're doing this as a shamatha practice? Right, who does it need any analysis? You know, I mean, this is pragmatic empirical science. You just observe, you know, what's right in front of you. So that's the power of that vipassana. And then we are going to, you know, at the end of the day tomorrow, we'll do something that is akin to that. It'll be shamatha practice, you know, it'll be this practice of simultaneous stillness and motion, but just adding a little bit of vipassana, but without doing inquiry, really. All you're going to be doing is observing, you know, and then your inescapable conclusions might become more and more elaborated after you've had an excursion into pristine awareness and non-meditation, which will happen to you in the morning. That's on the schedule, you know. I think I've heard Alan say that the difference between shamatha and rigpa is the view. Can you elaborate? So it would be the So the achievement of shamatha. So rest, and I think what this person means is resting in substrate consciousness. And so the difference between there are a couple of other, well, there are more than that. There are several differences, actually, and we're going to go into those tomorrow when we get into the ground and identifying pristine awareness. But so this is definitely true, but it's not the only difference. But it is a difference between the achievement of shamatha and resting in pristine, or the view. Let's just say the view from substrate consciousness and the view from pristine awareness. And so there, the view from substrate consciousness is that there doesn't include a worldview about the nature of what you're examining or what you're observing. But definitely with pristine awareness, again, the view is inescapable. But we'll talk more about that tomorrow. There are two sequences of meditation practice I've learned. Mindfulness of breathing, settling the mind to awareness of awareness, course to settle. So awareness of awareness is not a breath practice, though. So if this was awareness of the breath, then that would be, mindfulness of breathing leads to settling the mind. Mindfulness of breathing leads to settling the mind, leads to awareness of awareness. Oh, I see. Okay. Oh, so this is a sequence, yeah. Two sequences. Mindfulness of breathing leads to, there are arrows, leads to settling the mind in its natural state, leads to awareness of awareness. That's not quite right, because awareness of awareness is one of the four types of practices within the class of settling the mind in its natural state. But course leads to subtle, yep. And then mindfulness of breathing leads to awareness of awareness, leads to settling the mind. Again, same comment that, if settling the mind, so settling the mind is usually a class of, well, it's two, Ellen uses that term in two different ways. So settling the mind in its natural state includes awareness of awareness, merging mind and space, and also this practice of settling, what is often called settling the mind in its natural state, which is probably why that's not such a great term, but taking the impure mind as the path, taking appearances and awareness as the path, taking aspects of the mind as the path, is a lot more accurate as the practice where you are actually dealing with appearances that arise within the space of the mind. So appearances rather than no appearances. So shamatha focused on conceptualization rather than non-conceptualization. I'm kind of getting lost with these sequences. So establish the observatory first. So mindfulness of breathing leads to awareness of awareness, and then settling mind. Okay. Yep. Okay. So basically, here are the two sequences that this person is referring to. The inverted order that we did today, where we you go from rough breath meditation to then awareness of awareness in order to find that inertial frame of reference of stillness, and then we are going into taking appearances. And then the other way is that the approach that Alan and I have taught before, where awareness of awareness comes at the end of the progression and merging mind and space. So, okay, now I understand. I wonder which sequence is best. Could you please advise? I don't know which is best. I think that you could become enlightened with either one. And I think that people have become enlightened with either approach. And it's nice to have both. And I think it's nice to experiment with each and see which works best for you. And so in having gone through both of them, my current, what's the going steady called? Or is there a term for going steady these days? I'm hooking up right now. I'm hooking up with what we did today. So this is, you know, I for the reasons that I've been explaining, I like this approach of doing the awareness of awareness first. Because it really, I think, does prepare you to have that framework of stillness, and then you take that stillness, as I've been trying to coach you into, you take that stillness in to on the sliding scale, and then you watch the movement of appearances arise within that still spaciousness. So it's harder to do that when you just are told basically that the king is sitting on his throne and remains unmoved, or it's like a lighthouse or something like that. Or, you know, metaphors like that, but it's different than having that experience of stillness. And then that the practice of in my experience, the practice of what we're, let's just call it simultaneous stillness and motion, or I mean, really the shamatha focused on conceptualization, that now you really know what I'm talking about, is so compelling. And that's the reason that it really is the whole of the practice for in these four types of mindfulness of the essential nature of the path, that if you put awareness of awareness at the end, emerging mind and space at the end, you don't really get there because you get stuck, not really stuck, but you're just working on, you know, in the progression, this, and it's really hard to master. And so you don't really kind of move on except it's just these brief excursions, you know, in a retreat, but as far as your own practice goes, it's just, you know, this practice that we're doing of simultaneous stillness and motion is just so compelling and demanding, and that it just becomes, you know, you don't go move on because you don't feel like you've mastered this, you know, if you're getting that progression. So I'd say try them both, and you know, the four modes of mindfulness, the other thing is that I think this really works well in the way that we presented it today, with awareness of awareness first, or stillness first, works really well with this four types of mindfulness. And so if your practice is, you know, really focused in this four types of mindfulness, then it makes sense, I think. And I think it's really helpful to make that, you know, the awareness of awareness a serious practice for you for some time, and get really, really used to it, you know, and because it's really not all that difficult. You know, it's easier than the simultaneous stillness and motion, I think. And, you know, and then when you get that kind of down, then take that into the more comprehensive practice, the real practice of taking aspects of the mind as a path. Are the terms pristine awareness and Dharmakaya describing the same thing? Not quite. We'll go into that tomorrow. What do you think about changing the object during a session, i.e., something, stability, to something. So changing an object within a session. So that's okay if you do it with intention and you know what you're doing. But if you don't, if your object is changing during a single session, that's different than you changing the object, right? And so here's the analogy again that you're all familiar with. What is the best gear on a 21-speed bicycle? Yeah, right. It's the titanium one in the cluster, right? You know, it's the same question as what, you have a gold key, a brass key, you know, and a wooden key, or a copper key, which is the best one? Yeah, the one that opens the door. You know, so what gear is the best on a bicycle? What is the best object of meditation? And you might discover, so it depends on what terrain you're on. You know, so it could be that, especially if you're doing multiple sessions, that what you begin to notice is that one session can be radically different than the other. There's not always a smooth progression. And so you were just so stable and vivid in one session, and then the next session, you're just totally scattered. But you start that session with the same object that worked so well with you in the previous session, but you have basically just come to a steep hill. You know, your terrain has changed. So then you respond to the change of terrain and you shift down. So you have, you know, the analogy of your the gears in your cluster would be breath. So basically things that we didn't even go into in this retreat, but that we have in the past. So going to the infirmary would be granny gear, right? So the steepest hill, it is the most difficult when you're really mentally afflicted, you just got the performance review, and you know all that is going through your mind, what you should have said, what she said, et cetera, et cetera. Then you can just go to the infirmary with basically all that, your whole goal there in the infirmary, because you need first aid, you just got beat up, you got mugged, is relaxation. And so if you just lie down in Shavasana and you can close your eyes, and if you do fall asleep, it could be worse. It would be worse. You know, it's the infirmary. And so that is granny gear. And then if you know, hopefully you don't stay on that kind of terrain for very long. But then the next would be breath meditation with attention focused on the abdomen, because that is a coarse object. Then attention focused on the more subtle sensations of the breath at the nose. And then Asanga's mindfulness of breathing. You know, so you're becoming more and more, the objects are becoming more and more subtle. And then awareness of the breath. So that's five or so gears of breath meditation. So generally, when you're out biking, isn't it true that faster is better? Generally, I mean, you choose the gear that is going to get you going fastest. You know, and fast might be really slow going up a steep hill, but going downhill, you're not going to be in granny gear going downhill, you know, because you want to go fast downhill. And, you know, on the flat you go, find the gear that allows you to go as fast as you can in, you know, with the right RPMs. But, I think the same analogy, you choose the most subtle object that you can, because has the greater potential, I think. And then, so you then have done awareness of the breath, and then, so that has set you up because of the 80-20, right, for awareness of awareness, right? Because all you do then is drop the 20% that knows the rhythm of the breath, and there you are, shamatha without a sign. So you do shamatha without a sign. You could throw in then merging mind and space after that if you wanted to, you know, what we did in the breakout session where you're oscillating the invigoration of awareness of awareness and the release into space. And then, you know, the big game is simultaneous stillness and motion. You know, and that's why basically it's the only practice that Dujem Lingpa taught, you know, two skills, recognize the difference and then simultaneous stillness and motion, to take you all the way up to single-pointedness, which would be level 8 of shamatha. What can we do to foster spacious awareness, both in meditation on the cushion and off? Don't grasp to appearances. And there's more, obviously, you know, so we'll be talking more about that tomorrow as well. Basically, non-meditation, but basically most of what we're going to be doing is spacious awareness. Not entirely. But so the thing about spacious awareness is that it's the natural state of the mind. And just recognize that space is can be affected. It's not self-existent either, and it is affected by causes and conditions. And so that space can expand and shrink. Are you small-minded today? Or are you big-minded today? So what does small-minded mean in the ordinary vernacular? It means that you're aware, the space of the mind is shrunk down to my own self-interest. And that's all I can think of. I'm just so small-minded and petty. And so Lama Allen has used this analogy of when the space of your awareness or your sphere of concern, more accurately, has shrunk to the size of a teacup, and you drop a golf ball into the teacup, what happens? Tsunami, right? Disaster. You know, and you're an ant on the edge of that teacup, you know. You know, total chaos. But what happens if your sphere of concern has expanded to the size of a swimming pool and you drop the same, let's just say the golf ball was a critical remark from somebody that is important to you and they were critical of you and it wounded you. You know, if the sphere of your concern is a small little teacup, you know, it's going to ruin your whole day. But if your sphere of concern is as large as a swimming pool, hardly a ripple. And then what happens if the sphere of concern is as large as the Atlantic Ocean? You know, it's only an appearance. So that's how to maintain the spaciousness of your mind also, is expand the sphere of your concern is another one. I'm tempted to stand up when experiencing laxity, but don't, because I don't want to disturb others. Is it okay to stand up from a seated position? Yes. I was going to mention this, but didn't get around to it. So this person intuited the right answer, though. So we want to remain absolutely still in meditation. And you choose a position in which you know that you can remain in that position for 24 minutes without moving, because you want to, for you know, preserve the stillness of your own mind and preserve the community. There's one exception, and that is the laxity is so pernicious that you have to, the one thing that you can't do with laxity or dullness is to sit there and put up with it. So don't do that. Because you just are training yourself to be comfortable in this twilight zone of being spaced out. So the trick to dealing with laxity is introspection. So first of all, notice it, because you know there's a scale. With excitation, you're on your object and then you're off it, like that, you know, whew. The vacuum, you know, it just, you have an instant of vacuum and then the ruminating mind rushes in. It can be a fraction of a second. But with laxity, there's a progression. There's a slow, steady slide. You begin by not being vividly engaged, and that's true laxity. And then, you know, there is lethargy, there is torpor, there is stupor, there is snoring, you know, there is just a whole scale of basically your awareness collapsing into itself. And so the trick is to recognize laxity while it is just beginning to occur, and then you can apply a, you know, very subtle antidote, like raising your gaze or so, checking your posture, all of that. But sometimes, you know, it just happens. And this can happen if you're in Shavasana or in seated position. And then that is the great exception to the rule of remain in your position and then don't move so that you're not disturbing anyone. And the only thing that it's going to do is I'm going to have to, if I see somebody get up in the middle of a session and they stand up, the biggest problem for me is restraining my applause. Because truly, I just feel, damn, they got it. They did it. You know, and it's more gratifying to me to see somebody do that, to recognize that they have a problem and apply the appropriate antidote on the spot rather than sit there and put up with it. And if somebody does sit there and put up with it and is just, you know, nodding off through the whole session, I just feel frustrated and a little annoyed, because they haven't gotten the message about, and the introspection just isn't there to recognize what's going on. So anybody that does do that, the people who are standing up, it just always gives me a thrill of joy to see that, people who are standing up, you know, who start a session standing up, because it just is proof that they know what's going on in their own minds at that particular moment, and they have applied the appropriate antidote. So, glad you asked that question. When practicing stillness and motion, using partial lucidity with appearances, if the appearances are subjective as opposed to objective, isn't that just rumination or contemplation? So using partial lucidity, so basically the appearances are flowing and you are partially lucid, meaning that you're not actually recognizing their nature, for instance, as in lucid dreaming, but you could reconstruct the whole chain of association at the end of a long chain. And if the appearances are subjective as opposed to objective, isn't that just rumination or contemplation? So I don't know why what the connection between rumination and contemplation is. But is it just rumination? I don't think so, because rumination, to me, connotes total non-lucidity. And you don't know what's going on. And rumination is just oftentimes, so rumination to me just connotes, and again, you know, all these terms are kind of slippery when we apply them to these things, and so we kind of are defining, using ordinary terms and then kind of defining them as we go so that we all agree on what they actually mean. Rumination to me connotes chewing the cud, like a ruminant, like a cow. You know, you sit down, and then deer do that too. It's like their jaws almost dislocate, you know, and they're just. And, you know, it's the same thing over and over again, and then you swallow it, and you vomit it back up and chew it again. So, right? Isn't that exactly what rumination is? You know, and rumination, the power of rumination is so important in anger especially, but in a lot of other emotions that are painful or, you know, that we think of as negative or that have a painful charge to them. So anxiety is also depends on rumination. But anger especially. So what you do is there is a trigger and then you ruminate about, you know, what the son of a bitch said, etc. And what you're doing then is that the rumination acts as a re-triggering. Because the thing about emotions that Paul Ekman really discovered in his research is that they are really ephemeral, they're brief. So why, and the longest is really about 2 minutes. You know, so why is it that how is it then that a 2 minute emotional experience can become a mood that actually dominates your whole day? How can it become a disposition? How can it become a trait? All of those things. But how is it that you can be angry all day long? Well, it's re-triggering. So there are different emotional episodes of the same family, basically, but you have an emotional experience and then you re-trigger it. And then as it's re-triggered, so talking about rumination, you know, but really, as it's re-triggered, it becomes more intense as it spirals up. So the re-triggering makes you are more prone to a subsequent experience and it becomes more intense. So that is rumination. So rumination implies to me a definitely not non-lucidity. And I think people, if they were really ruminating, and especially a lot of people would like to be free of their ruminations, you know, because they can be obsessive and you just go, God, again, you know, I've had it with it. You know, why can't I get over this? You know, it just won't leave me alone. And I think those people would be delighted to be half lucid with an appearance that arises. So, are you with me? It's late, getting late, but, are you up for a bedtime story? Okay. This is pretty extraordinary and really relates to what we did today and what we'll be doing tomorrow. And there is a section. There aren't many sections. Well, there are a few. But there aren't all that many section headings, actually, in this, because it's all just kind of the flow of his visions. But here's a section heading, and I think it really indicates to during this particular period of his life or this particular year, this was a theme of the appearances that appeared the Dakinis and the Mahasiddhas and the gurus that appeared to him. So the heading here is the sacred practice of space. That year, the pig year, this is also the pig year, this year, the earth pig year. That year, the pig year, 1851, I turned 17. On the seventh day of the first summer month, I was doing what I called, quote, meditation, hoping that something would happen that I could see or feel. I sat with my back to a cliff, my body drawn up straight without shifting or movement. On the last of 7 days, I fell asleep or dreamt of a young naked boy, one span in size. He ran and jumped across a flower-filled grassy meadow, stared at me with piercing eyes, and said, "In the body, like an empty city, speech is made by the mind in a constant stream. Mind is the creator of all myriad fabrications." A small girl appeared and responded, "Very so. In the body, like an empty paper tube, speech is like wind moving through its opening. Mind is what carries out various activities. Apart from recognizing which is chief among this trio, to wait for something you can see or feel during what you refer to as, quote, meditation is shocking." The sound of her raucous laughter woke me up, and I examined that the body is made by the mind. Due to the appearance of the body, the manifestation of verbal expression occurs through speech. Where there is no body, what only appears as a body is also the mind. Where there is no speech, what arises as verbal expression is also the mind. In fact, there is nothing apart from mind. Having come to that conclusion, I continued to wonder why the young boy explained it as three things. Once again, I sat with my back up to Marshar Cliff. As soon as I focused my attention on a small stick, from the cliff face behind me, a tiny red bird sang with a pleasant voice. "I, the young boy, am not telling lies. These days, some teachers do not understand the meaning of what only appears as the three doors of body, speech, and mind, where there are no doors. So they identify each of them as a trio. So they identify and teach them as a trio. Therefore, I taught accordingly. You've realized the conclusion that the three doors are inseparable and are merely appearances. How wonderful. That's it. Within the three Vajras indwelling state, body, speech, and mind are inseparable and complete. How right you are. Although now you realize that the three doors are only mind, exactly what is the form, shape, and color of that which creates and does everything? What we refer to as mind. I deem you incisive if you know the way things actually are." Then it flew off. Once again, I sat with my back against the cliff. At one point, these words resonated from the empty space of sky. "Mind is emptiness. Emptiness has no shape or color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no phenomena. Analyze this with your mind." I examined what was said, and I saw and understood that the absence of any objective domain is the essence of pervasive emptiness. However, since I was unsure how I should meditate, I settled in an unfixated state of mind for the time being. And then here's the really juicy parts. Can you imagine just having, you know, all of this appear, you're sitting down to meditate for and 7 days later, you have a vision, you know, and giving you the keys. That year, at night, on the 10th day of the 12th month, as before, an immense river of blood surged and changed into dark blue like a raging river. My mind became space. I experienced the river of light flowing down from that expanse, and then all apparent phenomena dissolved into it. At that point, a youth with a blue body wearing blue attire appeared, saying he was Orgyen Soki Dorje, lake-born Vajra. He said, "Isn't this your visionary experience extraordinary?" I replied, "At first, this vision arose as blood, which was terrifying. Later, it appeared as utter darkness, and my mind was exhausted. Finally, it manifested as rainbows. Now it appears like a waterfall of dark blue light. If I examine how this unfolds, I can compare it to a rainbow appearing in space or a reflection upon a water. I think that all phenomena are nothing apart from space. Yet, at the same time, how is it that space is wide open, emptiness, without faults or qualities? As for what is called mind, for example, if there is no fire, there are no sparks. If there is no water, there is no sound of water. And the reflections of planets and stars won't appear. If mind has no basis, thoughts and appearances can't possibly arise. If this mind dwells in my body, outer appearances can't possibly arise. To whom does a dreamscape, earth, rocks, mountains, cliffs, firmness, solidity, appear? In the morning, it vanishes without a trace. When I examine that, the true nature of mind appears within mind's expanse. That's what I think. You've almost realized the view. Now, tell me about your meditation practice." "Since I don't know how to meditate, you should teach me how," I insisted. Oh, child of my spiritual family, each master employs a different style of teaching meditation. Some claim that you must block thoughts. Some say that you must gaze directly at thoughts and be aware. Some claim that you have to cultivate thoughts. Some claim that you have to cultivate thoughts, then rework the negative ones. Some contend you must merge mind and space. It's astonishing the myriad forms of happiness and suffering that occur due to the fault of not naturally settling, as is the mind's nature. Some even assert that mind is emptiness, and you also have to maintain a very subtle perception. Some even assert that the mind is emptiness, and yet you also have to maintain a very subtle perception of mental consciousness. Whatever you name these, however you label them, they are definitely not the correct path. Now, if you wish to enter the true path, understand that pure lands above, impure cyclic existence below, and all environments and beings are nothing other than the nature of reality's space. Once you've recognized their single innate flavor within space, space is fully evident. How do you create a more spacious mind? Once you've recognized their single innate flavor within space, space is fully evident. Settle undistracted within that continuous nature. What does it mean to be undistracted? It is to have neither a focal point nor clinging, no meditation or fixation, no nurturing or preserving. It is beyond expression or description, or yeah, it is beyond description or expression. Just as it was before, leave the mind to itself, unfettered. I asked, how should I handle all these thoughts? Boy, what? Isn't this nice to hear? Advice directly from Guru Rinpoche. The youth answered, it's incorrect to block or to hold on to thoughts in any way. Know that without attachment to any sort of understanding, sensation, or experience, let thoughts go. Do I look at space with my eyes? He said, look from within a state of uncontrived natural repose. That's it. I asked, is looking into space with my eyes incorrect? If mind doesn't see mind, even if space becomes apparent, how could that be helpful? Gazing at mind with mind entails the duality of a looker and something looked upon. Therefore, looking at thoughts with your intellectual mind is like an old person watching a child's game. It's pointless. All cyclic existence and enlightenment are nothing other than space itself, within which they are of a single flavor. Once you recognize that indwelling state, it is sufficient to not turn your eyes from space. So once you recognize that indwelling state, it is sufficient to not turn your eyes from space. That is meaningful because original awareness perceives the visual consciousness. This is getting into Tukyal, which has no essence apart from that awareness. A corpse doesn't have eyes to which forms appear. In dreams, appearances of forms manifest without eyes. In the intermediate state as well, appearances of forms manifest without eyes. You don't need eyes for there to be visual appearances. Use these examples to understand primordially present insight. All sentient beings have not actualized the basis of being, so they are deluded. Putting that aside, you can see that because thoughts or concepts aren't different from the basis of being, there really is no delusion. Look at how all sentient beings are deluded because of their obsessive attachment to thoughts. Therefore, thoughts are something that you can be transformed. Once you apprehend the incisive certainty from deep within that all phenomena of cyclic existence and enlightenment never transcend the nature of space, that is called pure space. Throughout the past, present, or future, it's not right to even to throughout the past, present, or future, it's not right to ever stray from the state in which that indwelling nature is obvious to you. If you accomplish the vital training of familiarizing yourself with this, in the end, unformulated basic space beyond limits, the nature of reality, will become apparent to you. For example, just as at dawn there can be no darkness, you will surely reach meditation practice free from exertion and effort. Then he vanished. So there's, you want to hear his reflections on that conversation? It's a little bit long, you know, it's another 3 or 4 minutes. From that time forth, I made my spiritual path simply not taking my eyes away from space. So just a footnote, he's really beginning to talk about what happens after you, after Treksha, which is cutting through to pristine awareness. Then the fourth element of the essential path is Tukyal, which is the direct crossing over or the leap across. And that involves a series of practices that are secret. And they involve a particular channel in the subtle body that is not known or used in any other tantra in existence. And there is a name for it that I'll just keep secret. But I don't know anything about these practices. But it involves visual consciousness, so that's why he's talking about space, visual consciousness, and the highest practices that occur after you stabilize in pristine awareness. And which is why he was asking about gazing into space with the eyes, you know, and then but if you don't know the nature of mind, what good is it going to do to look into space? You don't have to, you know, have visual appearances, don't require eyes, that sort of thing. So from that time forth, I made my spiritual path simply not taking my eyes away from space. I cultivated that experience wholeheartedly and arrived directly at basic space, free from edge or limits, the nature of reality. My realization overflowed into that openness. Absolutely everything appears from either cyclic existence or enlightenment. Free from the multiplicity of elaboration, the essence of space is the arena of the original basis of being, which cannot be demonstrated by metaphor other than as space itself. Even the Buddha's Sublime Insight Sutras state that when you carry out the sacred practice of the perfection of sublime insight, you are actually engaged in the sacred practice of space. Be aware, this is the ultimate meaning of what has been taught. As things are outside, so they are inside. Whether outer or inner, everything is the natural radiance of what's within. Whatever the inner radiance is, it manifests as if outer. Separate things are exaggerated, given symbols and names. What is ineffable, inconceivable, and indescribable is expressed and thereby made definable. That inexpressible meaning is presented fully through illustration. This is the sage approach, the skillful means of the victors of the three times, an entryway that leads to ultimate basic space. Dualistic mind perceives objects. When your experiential mode has shifted to timeless awareness and supreme sublime insight seals phenomena as the dynamic expression of awareness, outer and inner become indivisible via the Kati crystal secret path. That's the channel. Of the eyes and space. So outer and inner become indivisible via the Kati crystal secret path of the eyes and space, and you recognize emptiness's true nature. The lion's roar of the discourse of the utmost sovereign spiritual approach terrifies the lowly minds of the herds of wild animals. The very nature of the extremely profound teachings is constantly challenged by ordinary minds. Inner truth, the primordially present body of ultimate enlightenment, is seen with your own wisdom eyes. If some method exists to teach this to others, why did the Buddha say it was profound peace, unformulated and difficult to fathom? He just leaves it with that question. And then the next section is called The True Meaning of Sublime Insight. So here's an autobiography. You know, if you've ever been tempted to write your memoir, and I have, I've thought about that, you know, and thought what would go into it. And he talks in the beginning about his strategy for writing this memoir. And he said, I am not going to dwell on the ordinary facts of an ordinary sentient being's life. I am going to talk only about my realizations, my visions, and what it is that produced, you know, who I am. So there you have it. What?
Well, what about White Llama? That was a fantastic book. Is that
Well, that was a biography. Oh, that's a long story. I will say that doing the research on this book that I wrote called White Llama, which is the story of Theos Bernard, who is a seminal figure of both bringing Tibetan Buddhism and yoga to the West, that was really... really strengthened, and I had an early connection with Padmasambhava early in my life when I was 18, but then never was able to pursue teachings with any teacher. So it was these, after going through the Gelugpa training for a number of years, then suddenly it was the research on this project with Theos Bernard, who had a very powerful connection to Padmasambhava, that really strengthened my own interest and intention and desire, and that frankly was the reason that I didn't go into three-year retreat at a retreat center that I built for three-year retreat, because I realized that I didn't have the practices that I wanted to do in three-year retreat, which was Padmasambhava practices. So I decided that as soon as I was free, I would go off looking for Padmasambhava practices. So, yeah, you might have something there. So, it's a great mass of merit that you have created today. By the goodness of what you have done, may this pleasure, this not ripen, this virtue ripen as simple pleasure that comes and goes. But may it ripen as ultimate benefit for the greatest number of beings possible. May it ripen with you because of your motivation, your interest, your dedication to developing samadhi. May it ripen actually as the achievement of samadhi in all beings, so that all beings may use samadhi to power through to authentic insight that eliminates suffering and its causes for all time. May it be so, by the goodness of what you have done.